This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Iran State TV says that the country's sole nuclear power plant has undergone a temporary emergency shutdown. An official from the state electric energy company said on a talk show that the plant shutdown began on Saturday and would last for 3 to 4 days. He said that outages could result. He did not elaborate, but this is the first time Iran has reported an emergency shutdown of that plant located in the southern port city. It went online in 2011 with help from Russia. In March, Iran said the plant could stop working since it could not buy the needed equipment from Russia because of sanctions put on it. Afghanistan's former president says the United States came to his country to fight extremism and bring stability to his war-tortured nation, and it's leaving now nearly 20 years later, having failed at doing both. In an interview Sunday with the Associated Press, just weeks before the last U.S. and NATO troops leave Afghanistan, ending the forever war, Hamid Karzai said extremism is at the highest point, and the departing troops are leaving behind a disaster. He says the international community came here 20 years ago with the clear objective of fighting extremism and bringing stability, but extremism is at the highest point, so ultimately they failed. U.S. President Joe Biden's special envoy for North Korea says that he hopes to see a positive reaction from the North soon on U.S. offers for talks after the North Korean leader ordered officials to prepare for dialogue and confrontation. This is VOA News. India's central government is calling on the public to continue observing anti-pandemic measures to reduce the spread of COVID-19 infections, even as some regions start to lift restrictions. Outside a subway station in New York, Delhi, hundreds of local residents could be seen flouting social distancing guidelines while waiting in line to take the metro. And outside a subway station in New Delhi, the metro authorities capped ridership to limit the potential for overcrowding in the subway cars, but unintentionally caused passengers to crowd outside the station, possibly increasing their risk of infection while they wait. The Indian government has repeatedly emphasized the importance of strict restrictions in controlling the pandemic, as COVID-19 shutdowns in various states are eased. The central authorities are reminding residents that public health measures like wearing masks and keeping socially distant must be maintained. The U.S. sent 2.5 million doses of the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine to Taiwan on Sunday, tripling an earlier pledge in a donation with both public health and geopolitical meaning. The shipment arrived on a China Airlines cargo plane that had left Memphis the previous day. The health minister and the top U.S. official in Taiwan were among those who welcomed the plane on the tarmac at the airport outside of the capital, Taipei. And it was said that the America was showing its friendship as Taiwan faces its most severe outbreak. Polling agencies and early official results estimate that France's traditional conservative party dominated the first round of regional elections and that Marine Le Pen's far-right party performed less well than expected. The election Sunday was marked by exceptionally low turnout and campaigning around security and economic issues. Three polling agencies projected that the traditional conservative party, the Republicans, would have the most overall votes, followed by Le Pen's national rally. And behind them were left-wing and green parties and President Emmanuel Macron's young centrist party. Regional elections are meant to be about local issues, but they were seen by many as a dress rehearsal for next year's presidential elections. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, June 21st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ethiopia's long-delayed election will take place today, Monday, but the opposition says it is only a political theater.
Nearly 50% of the country is not taking part. Nearly, it is an election without choice. It's only the ruling party that is competing against itself.
A member of Sudan's ruling Sovereign Council will comment on ongoing peace talks with the rebel SPLM North. Refugees in Kenya will discuss their plight on World Refugee Day. Liberia imposes new COVID restrictions amid rising new cases. And Senegal's opposition civil society will rally this Wednesday for democracy.
There is a need for mobilization. There is a need for the people and all opposition, but all civil society leaders to stand up on June 23rd and say that we do not want a third term by any president.
And Uganda and DRC presidents inaugurate a new cross-border road project. Those stories plus Samson Omale's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ethiopia's long-delayed elections will take place today, Monday, amid boycott by some opposition parties and the crisis in the country's Tigray region. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed says the election will bring about national unity. His Prosperity Party is expected to win. Merera Gudina is the chair of the Oromo Federalist Congress, one of the parties boycotting the election. He says he met Sunday with former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, head of the African Union Election Observer Mission, and told him not to take Monday's election seriously because it is a mere political theater that will not deliver on Ethiopia's three greatest needs.
Yeah, it is largely election without choice. And I don't think they could deliver Ethiopia's three greatest needs. Those are durable peace and stability. Secondly, to ensure the birth of democratic Ethiopia. Thirdly, to ensure a meaningful economic development.
Prime Minister Abe said that the election will bring about Ethiopian unity.
Well, unity cannot come because you said it. Unity can come if you work for it, if you can galvanize diverse forces and how to manage diversity. So that is where he's going to lose the game.
There are some areas in Ethiopia that are not voting. How come the whole country is not taking part in the election?
You know, that nearly 50% of the country is not taking part because, you know, the country's largest region, that is Oromia, from where I come, nearly it is an election without choice. It's only the ruling party that is competing against itself. Then the Tigray region is in turmoil out of the election schedule. Really, the nation is not in the election mood.
You had a meeting with former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo. What did you tell him?
One, the election is not going to deliver anything big. It is not going to address the country's three greatest needs. So I told him to advise the Prime Minister very quickly to move to an all-inclusive national dialogue. And then create, through the national dialogue, very quickly an interim government that can take the country to a new all-inclusive elections in about a year to avert probably the looming civil war in the country.
Ethiopian Electoral Board spokesperson Shemilis says that only three of the 49 registered parties are not taking part in the election. So he concludes that this is an example that there's widespread participation in the election.
No, the game is not the question of number. For example, the country's largest region, from where I come, two major groups who can really win, for sure, could have won the election, are not participating. This is around 40% of the country's population. Then the Tigray region, the country's third largest region, is out of the game. So adding up all this, around 50% of the country's population is not taking part in real election with choice.
Merera Gudina is chair of the Oromo Federalist Congress. He was speaking with us from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. A member of Sudan's ruling Sovereign Council says the government is committed to achieving a comprehensive peace agreement to end the suffering of the Sudanese people from years of civil war. Mohamed Hassan El Taishi has been a part of South Sudan mediated peace talks between the transitional government and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, led by Abdel Aziz Al-Helu. Those talks recessed last week for both parties to consult with their respective communities on contentious issues such as secularism or the separation of religion and government and a unified Sudanese army. El Taishi says the two sides have agreed on about 80% of the contentious issues. Now, he says, both sides must be willing to compromise on the remaining issues.
The main point I could see is 3 points. One is the security arrangement, which we call it a popular consultation. The third one is about the relationship between the state and religion. This is one of the main root causes in the war in Sudan for so long time. So this is the three issues we disagreed, and we're hoping to narrowing the gap between the government and the SPLM North. Until we can reach common ground, thus we can compromise these issues very soon, inshallah.
I was speaking with a Sudanese who observed the talks. He thinks there's the need for, say, the United States or the European Union to come in to pressure you and the Helus group to reach some kind of agreement quickly. What do you think?
First of all, the government made it very clear since we started, we need to achieve comprehensive peace agreement and in a very short time because the people are suffering. We need to end the suffer, and also we got very limited time on the transition government, and then we need to reach a peace agreement and then we can achieve other tasks that the transition government need to accomplish. So I don't think the government needs any kind of pressure. However, we are willing to work with the international community, and we consider the huge support that's come up from the international community during these talks and also during the last talks which we achieved Juba Peace Agreement.
I know you are doing this to return the country to democratic rule. Do you have time to continue these talks?
Of course. There is no main challenges for the government side to continue offer a good solutions and good options for the Abdulaziz Al-Helu and others to reach a peace agreement. I mean, when the government signed the Juba Declaration of Principles and agreed to go for separation religion and state, I think the government took a big decision and faced the Sudanese people about we need to save our unity for our country, and also we need to end the very long civil war. And I think that talk with the Sudanese people and that debate with the Sudanese people convinced the vast majority for the Sudanese people. We need to compromise on this, and we need to prepare this country to be a country for all of us, not for the few of us. And I think on the other side, Abdulaziz Al-Helu need to have this very hard discussion with the people in his area to compromise the issues like secularism and self-determination, because at the end of the day, we need to have peace agreement and we need to end the war and we need to keep our country united. And I think we can't do this unless we show very leadership for the two parties.
Thank you so much, sir. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and thank you, James.
Mohamed Hassan El Taishi is a member of Sudan's ruling Sovereign Council. He was speaking with us from the capital, Khartoum. More than 82 million people, including children, have been forced to flee their homes because of war, violence, and persecution, according to the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. The agency says while most people spent much of last year at home, refugees had to run from their homes just to stay alive. As Marie Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, many refugees in East Africa say they have no access to quality education and decent work opportunities.
The United Nations High Commission for Refugees, UNHCR, estimates that more than 1 million children were born in a life of exile in the last 3 years. With this year's theme, Together We Heal, Learn and Shine, UNHCR says most world leaders are unwilling to make peace, and this leads to many displaced people paying the price. Deng Chola Agwer is a South Sudanese born in Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, where the mother came to seek asylum.
My mother was among the first people who opened the camp, Kakuma, 1992. I've stayed in Kenya for all my life. My mother used to cook this local brew and to sell so that we could survive in the camp. In Kakuma also, we don't have like jobs provided for us.
Majority of refugees and asylum seekers in Kenya originate from Somalia with 54%, and other nationalities are South Sudanese, Congolese and Ethiopians. Remy Juma left his native country, the Democratic Republic of Congo, in 2014 after losing all his parents because of war. He lives in Kenya's Kakuma refugee camp. He says being a refugee is the most difficult thing he has ever encountered.
I ran from Congo because of war. I lost all parents. I was forced to fight for my safety. And I was lucky to come out safe and was lucky to get to Kenya. It is not easy to come from Congo to Kenya. Since I'm a refugee, I faced a lot of challenges on the way. Being a refugee is difficult here in Kakuma. It is not something normal. It is difficult, no house, no water, and a lot of difficulties.
Remy says he dropped out of school so he can find a job to sustain himself. Spokesperson UNHCR East Africa Regional Bureau Faith Kasina says 72% of refugees in the Horn of Africa are facing food shortage.
The situation has become even more challenging because, of course, of the socio-economic impacts of the pandemic.
With Kenya frequently threatening UNHCR to shut the refugee camps in the region, Kasina says Kenya is still safe for the refugees.
Kenya is currently hosting over 512,000 refugees across the country. This therefore shows that refugees have found safety, protection and hospitality in this country.
The UNHCR says the refugee day should serve as a reminder to politicians on the need to do more to prevent and resolve conflict and crisis that has been the major cause of people fleeing their country of origin. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiembo in Milwaukee, USA.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Batte in Washington. Today is Monday, June 21st. This past week, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni and his Democratic Republic of Congo counterpart Felix Tshisekedi presided over the groundbreaking ceremony of a cross-border road network. The two heads of state said the road would help promote bilateral trade and boost security between their two countries. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakarinji has more from Kampala.
The two heads of states met last Wednesday at Mpondwe, a border point between DR Congo and Uganda, where they presided over the groundbreaking ceremony for the road construction project that they say will boost bilateral relations between the two countries. Here is President Museveni speaking before the two leaders laid the foundation stone for the construction of 223 kilometers road project that will connect the two countries.
I'm very happy about the road project, which we have discussed in detail, but also the issue of security in the region.
Mr. Museveni said the road network was just the beginning of many other developmental projects between the two neighbors. Speaking through an interpreter, President Tshisekedi shared the same sentiments.
Je partage parfaitement
I perfectly
son
share
initiative
his initiative because it enters into my own idea of the integration of the countries. I've always said that instead of looking at each other as neighbors, but in terms of enemies or not friendly people, instead of building walls between ourselves, it is better to build bridges. And this initiative is indeed a very good example of what we must continue to produce between our two countries and between our people.
According to a memorandum of understanding signed in May this year, Uganda is expected to contribute 20% of the project's total cost, which is more than $300 million. Back in Kampala, at a busy Chikubo market, merchants are busy loading merchandise in dozens of trucks that clear the now-departed road from Kasese, Western Uganda, to DR Congo. One of them is Stephen Tangula, a Ugandan.
Well, you see, when the road is bad, the car moves bending, so they cut some those springs, and even the tires, sometimes they burst. Those are the problems which we have been getting there, where you can move maybe 1 week, then you take 2 weeks. But right now it is going to be easy. We're going to be using like 1 week.
In the 1990s and early 2000s, Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo fought a deadly war that led to a loss of lives and properties and prompted the Kinshasa government to sue Uganda for damages in the International Court of Justice. It is hoped that this road project is one way through which the two countries are mending ties. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Liberia has imposed new restrictions due to rise in COVID-19 cases. As Rita Jalobwe reports from Monrovia, hospitals are said to be running out of beds for the sick.
Liberian President George Weah made the disclosure in a speech to the nation last week following an emergency cabinet meeting about what he called the alarming increase in COVID-19 cases in the country. President Weah said he ordered the ministers of health and justice to put together new regulations to help curb the spread of the virus.
I have therefore mandated the ministers of health and justice to immediately formulate new regulations and protocols that will assist in curbing the spread of this deadly disease. These new measures and protocols, when announced within the next 24 hours, are to be strictly observed by all citizens and residents within our borders and will be rigorously enforced by the security forces when necessary.
In accordance with the president's mandate, Health Minister Dr. Wihimina Jala announced the following revised national COVID-19 health guidelines.
Passengers who have been traveling from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh within the last 14 days will not be allowed to enter into Liberia. All persons shall mandatorily wear their masks at all times in the public place. We are advising all our public offices to reduce their staff by 50%. Nightclubs, bars, places of entertainment shall close at 9 p.m.
Dr. Jala says violators will be fined and the country may likely experience another lockdown if citizens and residents refuse to abide by health protocols. According to the National Public Health Institute of Liberia, there are 38 new confirmed cases and 634 active confirmed cases, placing the number of total confirmed cases at 2,834 since the outbreak of the virus in Liberia. 95 persons have died from the virus and 2,105 have recovered from the infections. Rita Jrabwe, VOA News, Monrovia, Liberia.
In Senegal, the opposition movement for the defense of democracy, M2D, will hold a big protest this Wednesday, June 23rd, to commemorate the day that Senegalese stood up against an attempt by then-President Abdoulaye Wade to change the country's election laws. M2D member Yassine Fall says the protest will also send a message to incumbent President Macky Sall to abandon any plans for a third term. President Sall said in March this year that he has no intention of seeking a third term. But Yassine Fall says the president's recent actions indicate he wants to run for a third term.
On Wednesday, we are going to celebrate the day of June 23rd, which is a day where the Senegalese people stood up against the project of President Abdoulaye Wade. It was in June 2011 to try to change the national law that determines elections in Senegal in terms of how much percentage a candidate could have to win at the first round. So people stood up because they understood that President Wade was planning to win the elections and pass it to his son, Karim Wade. And he was trying to also give himself a third term. So this brought a very big uprising. And this Wednesday, we are going to celebrate that is really what was the victory of democracy in Senegal.
Now we have President Macky Sall in power. How does that relate to what's happening now in Senegal?
The day of June 23rd is really the day that Senegalese recognized in recent history where the people took back our democracy. Today, President Macky Sall has the intention to run for a third term. All what he has said before, all promises he made in terms of saying that this was his last term, he really has rejected those promises. So we know that there is a need for mobilization. There is a need for the people and all opposition, but all civil society leaders and the Senegalese citizens to stand up on June 23rd and say that we do not want a third term by any president.
I think I may have read or seen somewhere where the president has said emphatically that he has no intention of seeking a third term.
Yes, he has said so. And actually, he was the one who said that. I am the one who made this constitutional review that saying that no Senegalese president is allowed to do more than two consecutive terms. But today we know that anyone who's in the president's camp who says that I am against a third term, you are kicked out of the party or the government. And the president said he's no longer going to answer any question asking him whether he will run for a third term or not.
Yassine Fall is a member of the Movement for the Defense of Democracy and an ally of Senegalese opposition leader Ousmane Sonko. She was speaking with us from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. It's time now for Daybreak Africa's Post, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the proposal by the Confederation of African Football President Patrice Motsepe, who believes Africa can succeed where Europe failed, and launch a Super League, according to a statement released by the Continental Organization on Sunday. This comes at a time when a similar competition, which had been planned for Europe, was scrapped after a backlash of opposition to the idea. The CAF president says the concept of an African Super League is already in discussion. He also mentioned that CAF plans to learn from their European counterparts on how to go about it. But many believe that it was actually FIFA president Gianni Infantino who first mooted the concept of an African Super League. Staying with the Confederation of African Football, defending champions Al Hagli of Egypt remain on course to retain their Toto CAF Champions League title after beating Esperance by a lone goal in the first leg of a semi-final duel played in Tunis on Saturday. Mohamed Sherif scored the lone goal for the Red Devils in the 66th minute to hand them a vital win away from home and set up a slight advantage heading into next weekend's return leg in Cairo. Pitso Mosumane reflects on his side's victory.
I always tell the players that our team is a very good team, it's a strong team. I've seen Ali win without all the players. We had corona, we had injuries, we had everything. And Ali keeps winning without, it doesn't matter who plays, who doesn't play. So we need to keep the team like that, that everybody must understand that Every individual in the team is very important.
In the other semi-final played in Morocco, Kaizer Chiefs recorded a crucial 1-0 win away to Wydad Casablanca after Samir Nakovic's first half goal handed the South Africans a 1-0 victory over Wydad Club Athletic in Casablanca on Saturday night. Not many people give Kaizer Chiefs any chance against the Moroccan Giants, especially after they were humbled 4-0 at the same venue in the group stages. Arthur Zouane is Kaizer Chiefs interim coach.
We've done what we here for, what we came here for. We wanted to get a goal or two, and fortunately we got one. And that one, I think for now, it's okay. And hopefully that when they come back home, obviously they'll be chasing the game. They'll open up a bit, so we'll also try to punish them.
Staying with football news, Botswana National Football Association on Sunday confirmed that it will not renew the contract of Algerian-born national coach Adil Amourouchi when it expires in August. In tennis news, Tunisians Ons Jabeur defeated Russia's Diara Kasatkina in straight set of 7-5, 6-4 to win her first singles title on Sunday to become the first Tunisian woman ever to capture a WTA title.
I struggled a lot. I've lost two finals and it's been tough for me to win a WTA title.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, June 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have a very good week.